Welcome to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films, every Friday morning from 9 to 10 a.m. Pacific and online at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Kaspar.
Within hours of his funeral, Hong Kong movie studios began to produce hundreds of unauthorized biopics, spin-offs, and rip-offs starring a competing roster of Bruce Lee lookalikes. Over the next decade, Bruceploitation would become a staple of global cinema. Today, we're joined by the director of a terrific documentary film called Enter the Clones of Bruce. He's also a founder of a very interesting distribution film company called Severin, and so many other aspects to his life in cinema, David Gregory. David, welcome to Film School Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I don't know where to begin. I want to ask you about Severin. I want to ask you about your other filmmaking exploits, but let's just start here. Where did you get the idea to do this particular documentary film about Bruce Lee?
Well, it started, I guess it's my interest in it started when I saw Enter the Dragon, the kind of big Warner Brothers Golden Harvest production from 1973, starring Bruce Lee. That introduced Kung Fu cinema to me, and I was blown away at 11 or 12 years old. Went back to the video shop and was like, I got to see more of this guy's stuff. And every video shop in England had like a martial arts or Kung Fu section. And lo and behold, there were lots and lots of Bruce Lee films. So I was like, okay, I've got my viewing sorted out for the next however many years I want to be with this new genre. But very quickly realized that he wasn't in most of them. I mean, Bruce Lee actually only completed four films in his lifetime. And Enter the Dragon came out after he died. So I quickly kind of lost interest in that until years later, we did a trailer compilation called Kung Fu Trailers of Fury. We found a bunch of 35mm trailers in an old movie theater in England and basically made a compilation out of it. And then the extras, we did audio commentary with Kung Fu movie experts. And one of these guys, Michael Wirth, his specific area of expertise was Bruceploitation. And it all came flooding back to me. I'm like, that's right, Bruce Lee, Dragon Lee. Who are these guys? What did they think of all this? So I started talking to him, and all of a sudden, just the kind of the floodgates of information opened, and what a sprawling, massive 10-year wave of exploitation film it was. And I've made documentaries before on the trenches of exploitation filmmaking and low-budget filmmaking. So many of them are just special features on discs, but I'd done features before. I did the one on the island of Dr. Moreau, Richard Stanley's failed attempt to make the island of Dr. Moreau. And then I did one on Al Adamson, the B-movie director who was murdered by his handyman and buried under his jacuzzi in Palm Desert. So I was quite keen to find the next subject that was worthy of a feature film as opposed to a special feature. And after I spoke to Michael, it clicked, and it was like, this has to be it. And it was the first time I'd done a documentary where I didn't actually really know the subject that well. I was like, okay, this is going to be a voyage of discovery for me. Luckily, I've got Michael with me, and also Frank Jeng, who had contacts in Hong Kong, who could actually find, we gave him a massive list of interviewees we wanted. But in this case, we didn't actually know if a lot of them were even still alive, because there was no information for them online. So it was up to Frank to kind of track down many of those people, and we just shot off to Hong Kong and started shooting. That was 6 years before we actually completed the film. So it was quite a long road.
You are in keeping with the tradition of film, documentary filmmakers that I have talked to, and that is you're not quite sure where you're going to end up, but you don't care. You're just going to go forward and see what happens. And it's such an amazing trait to be able to call upon if you're a filmmaker in this realm, because it is almost always an act of faith, right? It's almost always.
That's right. I mean, you have kind of a skeleton of an idea of what the story is from, you know, I did a certain amount of research before we went to Hong Kong. But, you know, again, there was very little English language information directly from the filmmakers and the actors about this subject. So basically, we were going to ask them all the questions like, how did you feel about this? You know, how did you get away with it? How did these films, why were there so many? You know, how prolific were you? How often were you working? Because it seemed like there were so many of these movies being made, and there were. And sure enough, it was like, but getting the three main Bruces was the key, which is Bruce Lee, Dragon Lee, and Bruce Lee. And so that was really the key. And they all have their own kind of biographical story arc within the bigger story arc of the film, which was another thing that made it a complicated production, because A, they speak another language that I don't speak, and B, I'm trying to kind of structure this as a feature film documentary, you know, so all of that had to kind of be compressed to keep it interesting and consistent.
Yeah, and that's another thing. It's not as if the filmmaking industry in Hong Kong was exactly top-down operation. It feels like it was just, you got a camera, you got an idea, and you got a little money, you can make a Bruce Lee movie.
That was kind of it. I mean, they were independents the same way we have, you know, regional filmmaking here in the US, you know, and there's a lot of exploitation movies. If you've ever read Stephen Thrower's book, Nightmare USA, every state has their filmmakers who was making, you know, low budget horror movies or exploitation movies. Similar over there. I mean, they had the big studios like Shaw Brothers, you know, but then they had the fly by night independents who were like, let's have a crack at this. This is a way to make money. It was those companies that were making the Bruceploitation films primarily.
It's wild. And it's, you know, there's a part of me that feels like good on anyone who wants to pick up a camera and try to tell a story and follow your dream or whatever that might be, tell a story. There's another part of this is just straight up just trying to trade off of somebody's name that everybody would know. And you walk away with a bag full of money and nothing else. I mean, it's really just, it's sheer greed. But you have to balance it with, I guess you balance it with the audience's expectations, the audience enjoyment, who's getting taken here. Mm-hmm. I guess. I mean, I don't know if, maybe that's not a factor, but it just feels like you have it all.
Well, I think it's similar to how, say, the Italian exploitation film industry is. You know, you have the producers who are like, let's rip off this American film. We'll choose a director. He'll cast it with like a cast of maybe some washed up American actor and then a bunch of Italians and then pretend that it's a sequel to some American movie. Yeah. Well, it's similar here in that it was the producers who were the ones who were probably the most, generally speaking, were the ones who were most kind of brazen in the exploitation. But the actual directors and certainly the performers, they were taking it very seriously. Yes. You know, they're doing the best that they can with the resources that they have. And in the case of Kung Fu movies, you know, you've got to be very physically fit in order to pull this off so that it can look realistic and that the fights are, you know, captivating and the stunts that they do are death-defying in some cases. So, you know, it's not that they're not just like, oh, let's do this for fun. You know, they're actually taking it very seriously. And as you see in the film, they're working incredibly hard, like long hours, sometimes shooting two or three movies at the same time. And, you know, I saw the budget to one of these films, actually, The Clones of Bruce Lee, which is the one where a doctor basically figures out how to get some of Bruce Lee's DNA and make several Bruce Lees to fight crime. And it was tiny. It was tinier than a lot of the US horror film, the regional US horror films. And if you think about it, it's like, okay, well, they don't have any special effects or anything like that. And they can probably, as in the case of Clones of Bruce Lee, they were shooting a lot in people's back gardens and stuff like that. But you do need the people who can actually perform the Kung Fu to keep it riveting, you know? So yes, that doesn't cost much, but you do need the talent to do it.
And there is something about the democratization of filmmaking that sort of fits into this narrative as well. So all that, by the way, this is a little bit off topic, but maybe not so much, because in addition to Enter the Clones of Bruce, which we're talking about, David Gregory, you've also been a part of making the documentary films that all of us have seen in relation to wonderful movies, and then there's the features that go along with it. You've been making those kind of movies or those kind of documentaries for films like The Deer Hunter, Badlands, Faster, Pussycat, Kill Kill, Heathers, The Man Who Fell to Earth, and so many more. And I see on your list one that just reminds me of what we're talking about, which was the Mondo movies.
Yeah.
The Mondo Kane. What were they? Mondo
Mondo Carne was the first one. The films of Jacopetti and Prosperi specifically, which inspired, again, an entire wave for a decade of movies with Mondo in the title. And then that kind of evolved into things like Faces of Death and Traces of Death and stuff like that, where it would just be like, you know, compilations of death scenes. Whereas the Mondo films, again, it was a situation where I was fascinated by what these guys did, not just in, yes, these are very dated and now pretty racist films, and in a couple of cases were racist then as well, but what was particularly interesting to me is that there was these two Italian guys who dropped themselves into war-torn Africa and wanted to go shooting it, you know, and it's like that is like, you know, that is take some serious cojones to be able to do that, and what drives you to do that. With Mondo Carne itself, they were relying on the fact that people weren't particularly well traveled. There wasn't the Travel Channel to see, you know, developing nations or anything like that. So they were able to go to places that where cameras hadn't really been before in a lot of cases, and film stuff that would be considered weird to people in the Western world. And that's why Mondo Carne was such a massive, massive success. Even the song More from the Mondo Carne soundtrack got nominated for an Oscar and was played at my parents' wedding. It's like, you know, it's like that's how it permeated the zeitgeist back in the early 60s. And then they made Africa Addio, which is the one where they went into Africa after the British pulled out and it was just civil war. And they got some absolutely horrendous, shocking footage. But they were there shooting it on the front lines, them with their cameras. And then they made this absolutely absurd movie called one of the most shocking movies of all time, called Goodbye, Uncle Tom, about slavery. And and I was like, what were you thinking? I need to know, what were you thinking when you were making this movie? And indeed, their point, Prosperi was very much the anthropologist of the two. He did an enormous amount of research and actually wanted to present documentation in form of a movie of, you know, what the attitude was that led to slavery and, you know, what the attitude was of slave owners. But the way it came up with Jacopetti, who was the showman and the person who courts controversy, is something absolutely sensationalist, exploitative, and really quite horrific to watch, even though it's shot beautifully and scored beautifully, and it's got massive production values. It's just like, how did these movies exist? So absolutely, I wanted to find out from these two men while they were still alive in the early 2000s, like, what the hell were they thinking and how did they get this done? Yeah.
Let's not forget, in those Mondo movies, inevitably there were bare-breasted women as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. No, that was the other thing, was that basically, yes, that was a way that you could see nudity where you wouldn't necessarily see it in a mainstream movie in the early 60s, you know. And in fact, Goodbye, Uncle Tom actually has just come out on UHD. The 4K of Goodbye, Uncle Tom has just been released by Blue Underground, which is Bill Lustig, the director of Maniac and Maniac Cop. His company just released it. I was working for him back in the early 2000s when I made The Godfathers of Mondo, and the documentary is on that new UHD as well.
This could be a 10-part interview. That's what I was so impressed when it was presented to me that you had done this, and I started looking into your background, and it's utterly fascinating. And while I want to continue to talk about Enter the Clones of Bruce, I do, and it's out, it's available. You can order it on Severin.
Severinfilms.com, and then it comes out on digital platforms on April the 30th, and it's also doing a 21-city theatrical tour right now.
How did you get to this part of your career, where you're now the owner of a film distribution company, Severinfilms.com? You can find out more about what you do. How did that all come into your life?
Well, I've been a film collector and obsessive, particularly horror films specifically, since I was, you know, since I was preteens, you know, watching Hammer movies on television. And then when the video era came in, I would just watch anything that was horror whatsoever. But the thing that was unique in England was that everything got banned in 1985. Between 1983 and 1985, everything on video got banned, particularly horror movies. And so it was up to a network of horror aficionados to sort of talk to each other on the phone and write letters to each other to find out who could get an illicit copy of this, that, or the other. And so therefore that sort of trading in tapes and finding the best possible copy of a movie that you're not allowed to see was really the embryo of where I am now. And I ended up, and I, being a film fanatic, I was also one of those guys who made films on Super 8 when I was a kid, da, 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 da. I went to film school in Boston and then came back and started working in documentary in England. Then I got hired by Bill Lustig, the Maniac director, to do the extras for Anchor Bay's DVDs in that kind of boom of DVDs in the early 2000s. And because I'd done a documentary on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, that was kind of a self-finance thing. But he saw I'd done that. They needed extras for things like The Wicker Man and Heathers and Manhunter and the films that Anchor Bay were doing. Francis was another big one I jumped at the chance to do that. That was like a dream job. I was, you know, I was doing the Emmanuel films, Dario Argento movies, stuff like that. It was all stuff that was in my wheelhouse. So I loved traveling around the world and interviewing mainly Europe and America, but interviewing all these filmmakers about the making of these movies at a time when a lot of these people were still alive. I mean, it's amazing how many of them are no longer with us because we were talking about movies that were made 20, 30 years before, and this is in the early 2000s, you know? And so eventually I wanted to start my own label. So Severin became my own label. I got more into the idea of which films to license. And I was doing a bit of that at Blue Underground with Bill, where I was started to pick the movies. The Mondo Cane movies were among them because I wanted to make that documentary on Jacobean Prosperity. I don't even particularly enjoy watching the movies whatsoever, but I'm like, I want to get them so I can make that documentary. Anyway, I got into the licensing side of things, and then I started Severin in 2006, and we've been at it ever since. And it's just getting more and more interesting in terms of the kind of films we can tackle, because the people who are into the physical media, the buying of discs with the extras and the best possible presentation of the film and the great packaging, are people like us who are really, they want to know more and they want to see more and they want to see the best possible presentation of a given film, even if it's a film they haven't even heard of. We've got to the point now where there's enough trust among the audience that we're the same as them, that if we pick it, that it might be of interest to them. And it's certainly diversified way beyond just horror movies. You know, I mean, there's certainly a lot of cult movies, for want of a better word, like erotic and action and things like that. But there's also, you know, we've got a Mike Leigh movie. We've got a Peter Greenaway movie. You know, there's other stuff that's there. The stuff that Kayla Janice does with the folk horror box set and her documentary on folk horror, like that was films that a lot of which I had never even heard of before we licensed them. But that was exciting to me. So it just keeps on getting more and more interesting.
By the way, I don't know why I think that Severin is a cinematic reference. Where did Severin come from, that name?
It actually came, so I also named Blue Underground, the company that I worked for before, and that was Blue Velvet and the Velvet Underground with the Velvet taken out, so it's Blue Underground. So after people really liked that name, including us and including Bill Lustig, because he ended up taking it, so we went to the Velvet Underground catalog again to name Severin, and in the song Venus in Furs, Severin is...
I knew it sounded
many times. Yes.
It sounded.
It's from the book Venus in Furs. Got it from the Lou Reed song.
The great, magnificent Velvet Underground. Wow, that's great. Thank you. That's a great story. I'm glad I asked. In terms of Enter the Clones of Bruce, and it, as you said, it's going to be released April 30th.
30th, yes, on digital platforms, it's April 30th. And then the physical disc will be out mid-May from our site, and then the wide release is in June.
The reaction among people who we see in the film, I mean, some of these actors that we see in the film, I'm sure that was probably, for some of them, the peak of their careers. Just kind of curious about the reaction to the film. Have you been getting a reaction from some of these people?
You mean from the people in the film?
Or even outside of it that had, you know, who may have known Bruce Lee, or just in general, just sort of a vibe that you're getting from this community.
Well, so I'll give you an example. Bruce Lee, who is over here from Hong Kong right now, was the most prolific of the Bruce Lee. We didn't actually get him until very late in the process, because he was extremely skeptical about what it was we were doing. Like, are we pigeonholing him again back into that? Does he want to go back there? Are we laughing at him? Are we making fun of these kinds of movies? But eventually we convinced him we weren't. And sure enough, now that he's seen the film, he's actually very much on board with what we came up with, because we're not looking down on it and snickering at the rough edges. You know, there's a lot that's very funny in the story. There's a lot of very, you know, audacious techniques that we use by the exploitative producers, which are, you know, hilarious and jaw-dropping in some cases, and almost shocking in some places, of the way they exploited the death of Bruce Lee. But we absolutely wanted to show the human beings behind this, in particular the Bruces themselves, you know, and how they felt about it. I mean, I think Bruce Lai, who was kind of the most respected and the earliest of the Bruce clones that we cover, is the one who was so bittersweet about the whole thing. You know, he's basically, you know, he did get pigeonholed into that. He never really wanted to be a Bruce clone. He was told he looked like Bruce Lee. Doesn't look that much like Bruce Lee. He certainly doesn't think he does. But once he was in one film that was a success, he kept on getting cast in more and more and more. So ultimately Bruce Lai became his thing, and he just had to stick with it. As one interviewee says, Eric Tsang, who was a very successful martial artist and writer and director himself, says, you know, if he hadn't been a Bruce Lee clone, he might actually have had a lot more longevity in his career. But, you know, that was it. He was always going to be that Bruce Lee guy.
There's always a yin and yang to a career like that, right? Mm-hmm. You can get beyond it. It's not easy. I mean, a lot of very well-known, very respected actors in American cinema started out in those kind of films, just sort of slasher movies or just basically kind of a kung fu, an American version of a kung fu movie. And get beyond it.
But it's a stepping stone for filmmakers, actors, everyone, yeah, to be in low budget movies. I mean, it's very rare to be cast in a big budget movie in your first film, isn't it? So it's basically, that's just the stepping stone to get yourself in the professional environment. And I think people who are successful generally don't frown upon their humble beginnings. You know, that's you know, I heard Tom Hanks mention, was it He Knows You're Alone, and in an interview recently, which is directed by Armand Mastroianni, who's directed several exploitation films. And he didn't look down on it. He was like, he needed a job and it was paid. And he got he had his SAG card for it. So it was basically, you know, that's just what you do. Unfortunately, if you do get typecast as somebody like Bruce Lai did and couldn't actually break out of that mold and do anything else, then it becomes frustrating because you stay at the same level, and it's a level that you didn't put in a position that you didn't actually want to be in the first place.
Did Jamie Lee Curtis start out with the
Halloween? Yeah,
Halloween. That's where she started, right?
Yes.
Okay. I just wasn't sure if she'd had a career.
Yeah, and now of course she embraces it because she's making billions from being in new Halloween movies at the moment, and even mentioned it in her Oscar speech. I mean, she was quite patronizing. She called them her little B movies or something like that. But still, I mean, she embraced the fact that she was that scream queen from Halloween and that final girl, that great character, Laurie Strode from Halloween, and has now been able to go back to it and make, you know, a very tidy living from it. You know, even though she probably wasn't that well, I don't know for sure, but she probably wasn't that well paid originally, but it certainly kicked off her career.
Yeah. You know, and I had this conversation earlier with a filmmaker who made not a horror movie, but it's one of those shoot 'em up kind. It's a drama around a diner, and people come in, and it's almost like a Coen Brothers film, and kind of or a Tarantino film. It keeps ratcheting up the level of violence and your expectation of violence. And he kind of talked about it as a horror movie in that sense. And he'd made another film which was a horror film. And I made this point, and I make this often now with I'm relatively new to what I would call the horror genre. When I grew up, they were mostly exploitation films, and it just really wasn't my thing at the time. But I found that with horror movies, almost more than any other genre, and I think you could put noir movies in this category, that the audience is invested in what's going to happen almost more than any other genre that I can think of. Because oftentimes the audience knows more than the characters in the movie, right? Mm-hmm. So they have expectations as to what's going. First of all, they have expectations as to where this is probably going to end up, but they also don't know how you're going to get there. Yeah. And the audience allows the audience the space to be able to create their own version of what's going to happen before it happens. And yeah. I think in that process, you become more emotionally invested in ways that, as I said, are different than other kind of movies. If you're watching a Shakespeare movie, you're watching what almost any other kind of movie, you're not as invested emotionally, because I think the nature of horror films is there are the ups and downs. You know it's coming. So I just find that to be a kind of a fascinating aspect that I'd never really considered about.
Yeah, well, it's also a genre that's been around since cinema began.
Yes.
And continues to be successful the world over. You know, so there's something that appeals in popular culture to people about horror. You know, and that's just never changed, and it's still not. I mean, there are horror. You know, The First Omen is in theaters right now, which is the sixth, I think, entry in the Omen series. And then that's a studio property. So, but I mean, it was kind of the domain of international cinema and lower budget cinema up until Rosemary's Baby. And then, well, I guess Psycho was a lower budget Hitchcock film, but it was a studio film. So that you've got that. And then you've got Rosemary's Baby and then The Exorcist and The Omen. So there's kind of higher respected versions. You know, I'd even put Silence of the Lambs in the horror genre. But then there's been always a steady flow of independent and low budget horror that, and some that break out and become classics like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original. Yeah. And then others that just appeal to us horror fans, you know. Yeah. So something that continues to be made and continues to be popular.
Yeah, and you go back to the cabinet of Dr. Kilgarry, you can go back to Dracula and Frankenstein, you can go back, I mean, in the origins story for popular culture and popular films, being scared, fight or flight is a very powerful human impulse, and we all have that. So yes.
Well, and also being scared in a safe environment, yes, I think has a lot to do with it. You know, it's basically you feel a sensation that you're not actually in danger, but you feel the sensation of being in danger. You know,
exactly, and it's the best of all worlds, right? There's something about our brain that is wired for that, and knowing that you're not actually being chased around by a guy with a big knife is, yeah, I mean, you can enjoy that part.
Definitely preferable, yeah.
And it is preferable. Well, David Gregory, thank you. Thank you so much for Enter the Clones of Bruce. It, again, is available through severinfilms.com. It will be in theaters beginning on April 30th. And available also streaming, I believe that is, do I have that right?
April 30th as well on streaming platforms, yeah.
And you can go and get a lot of box sets of a lot of different wonderful films, especially unusual films. And your career is amazing. I want to have your career. It's too late, but I want to have your career, because I just think you've been doing what you wanted to do. You've enjoyed, it seems that you've enjoyed your time around film and being a part of
it. So, although I keep on setting more and more unachievable goals in the amount of these things that we can actually do. That's kind of the problem, particularly as I'm surrounded at Severin by other people with similar passions, and it's like, oh, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. But it's a minor problem in the scheme of things, because we are all still chasing the product that we're really into, you know. Yep. I mean, just as an example, the Game of Clones Bruce Bloitation box set volume 1 has just gone on sale at severinfilms.com as well, which also contains Enter the Clones of Bruce and 14 Bruce Bloitation movies that we've restored from original 35mm elements. So more so than any other genre that I've had to attack, or any other country's archival systems that I've had to deal with, the Hong Kong films, the low budget action films, they do not have any negatives left. They've thrown them away.
Oh,
and
God.
So basically we've had to scour the globe in order to find 35mm prints in some cases. Sometimes we've found internegatives, which is good, which is created in certain territories, you know, from the original negative, you make a interpositive and then an internegative in order to be able to strike prints. So you go to France or South Africa or Italy. I mean, these films were released all over the world, so that's good, but you have to deal with archives and collectors of prints all over the world to try and find the best possible element to restore these films. And it's not been easy at all. And in some cases, we've had to use a battered release print, because that's all there is left on the globe, in order to transfer that to 2K and then do the color correction and remove as much of the dirt and scratching as you possibly can. If you've ever seen like the kind of cliched grindhouse presentation of a kung fu movie, they're in terrible condition. You know, they're like, you know, splices, they're missing the end of the reel, they're splices all through the thing, they're sound jumps, they're dirt and scratches. Well, that those are the things we were faced with in some cases.
Yeah, well, congratulations and continue your good work. And I look forward to maybe another time you can come here and whatever you want to talk about. Trust me.
I'd be happy to. That would be my pleasure.
All right. Well, thank you. Again, we've been speaking with director of Enter the Clones of Bruce, as well as the founder of Severin Films. And you go to severinfilms.com, that SEVERIN.films.com to find out more about that. And David Gregory, thank you.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Film School Radio, the on-air online showcase for the best in independent documentary and foreign films. You can find out more about the program at filmschoolradio.com. I'm your host, Mike Caspar. Thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week with another edition of Film School Radio.